From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism examines the loophole in gun purchases in Wisconsin.
Later, when it comes to studying coffee and your health, where do scientists begin?
A lot of these studies for the benefits were done on up to 3 8-ounce cups of coffee, and that seems to be fine for most people.
Later, Milwaukee writer Paul Salcini closes the book on characters who have inhabited 6 books in a series set in Tuscany.
And we dispel some myths women deal with when it comes to working out.
They see someone who looks incredibly fit, and they think that they need to do a whole lot of cardio. And I tell them that it's really about the weightlifting. That's what's really going to change, lift, sculpt your body.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The website Arms List, which connects buyers and sellers of firearms, is being sued by the survivors of a woman killed in a multiple murder at a Brookfield salon and spa in 2012. Zena Houghton was killed by her estranged, abusive husband who had purchased a handgun from a man in a parking lot the day before. Such purchases don't require a background check.
The issue of private gun sales and expanding background checks for would-be gun buyers is the subject of an extensive article by the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Reporter Alex Arriaga joins us on the line from Madison. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, walk us through what the laws are regarding licensing for gun sellers and what the major loophole is in terms of background checks and gun purchases.
Sure. So when I say universal background checks, what I mean by that is an expansion on what is the federal law for background checks. So currently, licensed dealers are required by federal law to perform background checks on interested purchasers by the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act, which took effect in 1994. And the law has also been extended to shotguns and rifles. And so 18 states have now expanded on the federal requirement. And what that means is they've extended the requirement for background checks not only through licensed dealers, but also through private sellers, or require that all firearm transactions occur through a licensed dealer who performs a background check.
And realizing that each of these 18 states might have slightly different laws, at least when it comes to the federal background checks, who is it that is disallowed from buying a firearm under these background check requirements?
Right. So prohibited purchasers under federal law include convicted felons, fugitives from justice, somebody who might be committed to a mental institution, somebody who might be convicted of a misdemeanor for domestic violence, and under state law, I believe, also if somebody is under a restraining order for domestic violence.
But as you say, there's a loophole here, and that is for gun purchases that don't take place with a federally licensed gun dealer. Are there any restrictions governing those kinds of sales?
So a private seller, somebody who isn't a licensed dealer, and that means that they just occasionally sell firearms or sell firearms as a hobby or collectors type of people, they can legally sell firearms to anyone as long as they have no reason to believe or are unaware that the person is a prohibited purchaser.
So then what do authorities, people like, say, Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn, but other authorities as well, say expanding background checks would represent in the scope of preventing gun violence?
Yep. So I actually have been able to talk to a few researchers from Johns Hopkins or University of California who support background checks. One researcher found that when Connecticut implemented a universal background check law, they saw a 40% drop in the firearm homicide rate in the following decade, whereas in Missouri, after repealing their permit to purchasing universal background checks in 2007, the firearm homicide rates rose 23%.
Now, at the same time, the National Rifle Association and other opponents of expanding background checks claim that data shows background checks don't necessarily keep guns out of the hands of criminals. Is there data to support that notion?
So the National Rifle Association spokesperson did send me some of their own research from John Lott Jr., the founder of the Crime Prevention Research Center, who found that actually firearm homicides and robberies rose in states that expanded on background checks. And so there's kind of, you know, conflicting research to sift through.
Right. I mean, even I think you're right. Even some supporters of change say there are still some limitations, even if you know, universal background checks are expanded to include private purchases, and you know, that is that they don't necessarily keep guns out of the hands of someone who's determined to buy one.
Right. So even, you know, some of the lawmakers that have proposed this type of legislation, even leaders in Milwaukee, police chief, acknowledge that this might not be the entire solution to gun violence in the state, but it could be a step to keeping firearms out of some of the hands that shouldn't have them.
Right. These laws would only impact legal firearm purchases as opposed to illegal firearm purchases.
Right.
What did you hear from politicians who oppose the expansion of background checks?
So a couple of the Democrats who have co-sponsored the bill, like I said, they see this as not an overall solution, but a major step into reducing gun violence and keeping firearms out of the hands of people who want to cause harm to themselves or others. Republicans that I've reached out to have mostly been uninterested in talking about this type of legislation. Maybe they're waiting for federal action. Two states, however, have put this type of legislation on their ballot for the fall, Nevada and Maine. Nationally, there was this proposal, and when it was blocked, there was a major sit-in in U.S. Congress, and of course, Speaker Paul Ryan called that a publicity stunt, but it seems like there's not much traction right now.
Right. I mean, at the same time, the city of Milwaukee just unveiled a broad public safety strategy to curb violence, and it does not actually include a call for new gun legislation. Would you get the sense that Democrats at this point, lawmakers, just see the issue as a non-starter in Wisconsin?
I think there is an overall attitude that this kind of legislation hasn't gotten much traction, and there's overall, I think, you know, one of Milwaukee's lobbyists that I spoke with kind of had a pessimistic attitude about getting this or any other type of firearm legislation moving between either the Republicans or the Democrats.
I was interested to read that many gun dealers seem to line up on the side of expanding these checks. What reasons do they give? I mean, is it that they're especially interested in public safety, or is there an economic motive here?
Right. So I went to this gun show in Waukesha earlier this month and didn't really know what to expect. Thought that, you know, a lot of these dealers would brush me off or be very against any type of firearm legislation. But some of the dealers actually have expressed this experience in which people interested in private sellers, for whatever reason, they don't want to go through the paperwork, they don't want to go through the background check, will, you know, walk away from their table as soon as the paperwork comes out. And so some of the dealers say, you know, criminals don't buy guns, they steal them. But at the same time, maybe passing universal background checks would mean that private sellers and licensed dealers would, you know, have the same experience where it would level the playing field, basically, where some of the licensed dealers say, well, this hurts my business, this hurts Milwaukee, this economically, it would be leveling the playing field, as one of the dealers said.
So how much of a challenge was compiling data about these issues? You've been on this story for a long time. You know, what's readily available out there, and what did you have a harder time finding?
Well, I think the biggest challenge to getting data on how a lot of these crime guns is basically there is no record keeping for private transactions of firearms. So, you know, when the city of Milwaukee even tries to investigate where some of the crime guns are coming from, they come into barriers where private sellers may not have records of who bought their gun, like who they sold it to. So they go to the original dealer source and their customer might say, oh, actually, that gun was stolen. And they might report that before or after the police approach them about where their firearm went. And so it's just kind of, it's a difficult trail to trace.
Well, Eric Sarriaga, thank you so much for walking us through the amount of the trail that you were able to trace. And nice job on the story.
Thank you so much.
Alex Arriaga is a reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. You'll find her article on expanding background checks for gun buyers at WUWM.com. We'll have more on the issue tomorrow during Precious Lives.
A quick break now, and then we'll return to our coffee series and walk through some of the most common questions about coffee and your health. This is Lake Effect on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. For some of us, it may be hard to be a functional human being without our morning cup of coffee or tea. But in a society that consumes what can be considered the most widely used drug on the planet so often, you have to wonder, is it actually good for us?
Coffee and the caffeine that's in it have been linked to dehydration, stomach problems, effects on your metabolism, insomnia, and other conditions. But what does the science actually say?
Local nutritionist Kim Flannery says you really don't have to quit making and drinking the black gold you so enjoy. She sat down with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to discuss coffee myths and potential benefits.
Well, there are definitely many advantages that are coming out in the research about at least possible benefits of coffee drinking. Of course, with anything with nutrition within moderate limits, but it is associated with liver health and also a lower incidence of type 2 diabetes, which those are two wonderful things, especially the type 2 diabetes with the incidence of that in the United States right now. Also, cognitive health seem to be some benefits there, lots of studies on that. Mood can be picked up, and I can talk about that myself because I do notice a little perk beyond the energy is great, and I enjoy that, definitely getting a start on my day, but also, I do think it makes me happy. I like coffee.
Yeah, I need the first cup of the day before speaking to someone or actually trying to function with your brain.
Right.
Do you think that because of, say, your mood is better and you feel more energized, that is caffeine good for you or is it bad for you? Or is there a certain point in consumption where there's a limit?
Well, there is a limit, and let's touch on the negative points because I just touched on some positive possibilities, at least, with coffee. But for some time, there was some suspicion that possibly it was responsible for high blood pressure, which we now know it does not cause high blood pressure. But with specifically the elderly and people who are pregnant, people who should be limiting their coffee consumption, there's a definite need for that. And as everybody is different, there will be different upper limits, I would think, within, you know, some flexible guidelines. But guidelines given by the March of Dimes for pregnant women is 1 cup per day, 1 8-ounce cup. But for most people, a lot of these studies for the benefits were done on up to 3 8-ounce cups of coffee. And that seems to be fine for most people. I would say knowing your body, like for me, I'll hit a point where a little's good and I will go over that point and know it right away.
Yeah.
So I get anxious and a little, you know, edgy.
What makes that difference between someone getting jittery from 1 cup of coffee versus someone who can handle 3 or 4 cups throughout the day? Is it the way our bodies process this individually?
It depends on how your body metabolizes the coffee. Also, size, like with anything that you put into your body, alcohol or any other substance that's going to affect your body in a way like that where it affects mood and functioning, cognitive functioning and things, size is going to make a difference. So just like a 200-pound man is going to handle his alcohol a lot better than someone like me who's 5'3 and not a large person. Mm-hmm. Same thing with coffee. So I know my husband can, for instance, handle a couple cups more than me.
And going back to coffee and performance, you mentioned people can get a little jump start to their mm-hmm. day and feel better, but can it aid you in exercise and in burning more calories? Does, say, having some coffee 40, 30 minutes before a workout, does that help you during that process?
I believe it does, based on the research I've looked at, and also my body as a laboratory mm-hmm. can tell you that, yes, if I'm going out for a run, I'm going to get a better run if I have a little kickstart from that coffee. But there are, again, plenty of studies that support moderate coffee consumption for athletic performance.
Do you think that negates what your body could potentially build up to on its own if you didn't have that boost?
Good question. I think, personally, I'm interpreting the research, but it seems like a little jump start above something that you could give your body, like you can train your body, and then if you had a cup of coffee, you'd still be a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is something there.
Okay. And what do you think quantifies as too much coffee in one day? Where does that line get crossed?
Well, recommendations looks like safe, beneficial effects were done on 3 8-ounce cups. And anything above that, probably you're getting into some iffy territory, again, size dependent. I can tell you right now that if I had 3 8-ounce cups of coffee, that would be too much for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say once you get beyond that, it's probably going to be getting on that edge of where it's really beginning to not be so good for you. Maybe even might have some negative effects of acid in your stomach and things like that.
Well, along the lines of acidity and mm-hmm. in your stomach-wise, how coffee can either upset you or perhaps calm things down, do you think iced coffee is better for your stomach and your digestive system versus hot coffee? Does that settle in a little better and cause less acidity and less reaction?
I don't really know the answer to that. But that does bring up something that I know was some recent research that came out. There was, within the last 6 months, I think, there was an article about coffee that was too hot and cancer risk. So I don't know if you saw that. But a lot of brewed coffee, I forget the temperature above which, it can be damaging to your esophagus, which could exacerbate like a esophageal cancer risk. Okay. So something to look out for. But again, that's hot coffee. As far as how it affects your stomach is going to be an individual thing. And I know that there are also other conditions that people can have, like acid reflux, for instance, where they might be told to limit or cut out their caffeine, their coffee intake, because that can aggravate conditions like that. But I guess as far as stomach comfort goes, it would be something that would be an issue to look at individually and see how does your stomach handle that and what's the difference between one cup and four cups and what's your good level.
Mm-hmm. Is there a certain brewing method that makes coffee better for you and your ingestion of it?
I haven't seen any studies that talk specifically about a lot of different brewing methods other than the distinction between like a French press or what we might call a Turkish brewed coffee as opposed to a regular brewed coffee, or even honestly espresso is more on the beneficial end of the substance in there that is filtered out when you use a filter making your coffee, which you would not get with the French press. It's all sitting in there together. And the substance called their diterpenes. And there have been studies associated with elevated LDL cholesterol and total cholesterol with those brewing methods. So you want something that's filtered, especially if you have a heart health risk.
Do you think there's one good time to have coffee? Is it best to have just coffee in the morning, or does it benefit your body to keep having coffee throughout the day? Does it become counterproductive, I suppose, if you have it too late?
I think it does. Although some people will tell me I can have a cup of coffee at 8 o'clock at night and go straight to bed. I cannot do that. I think a lot of people cannot do that. And with a lot of the people that I have nutrition consultations with, there is a lot of insomnia going on these days too. So for a lot of people, for most people, I think it's probably not a very good idea to have your coffee too late. For me, my cutoff is like 9 o'clock in the morning, I'm done. And I sleep well, but if I know I wouldn't if I had it into the afternoon.
So it's really about just kind of learning your limits.
Right. And I have had people tell me that they aren't affected by it. And I think possibly bodies get accustomed to what you give it. And if you ever try and wean yourself off of that, the more coffee you're drinking, probably the bigger headache you're going to have when you try and withdraw from it.
Right. And that can be attributed to also just the sheer sizes mm-hmm. that coffee can come into nowadays. So you mentioned the recommendation is an 8-ounce cup, mm-hmm. one cup of coffee. But yet you can get, 24 ounces and you have
right.
all of these different kind of sugary drinks. And while you say coffee is good alone, a lot of people associate coffee with adding cream and sugar. So does coffee with those added elements decrease the benefits of just having coffee alone if it were black?
Yes. It depends, too. What are you adding to your coffee? If you're adding milk, like you're having a, a skim latte, you're not adding a lot of extra calories. You're adding some extra calcium, vitamin D, things that your body can use. And even if you don't consume dairy, you could have a soy milk or an almond milk, which would have those nutrients in there. So that could be a positive thing. But unfortunately, when I'm in Starbucks ordering drinks, I hear a lot of orders for very good-looking drinks, that fancy drinks with a lot of sugar in them. And that definitely is a nutritional concern these days, is added sugars in our diet, which there is quite a bit of research on the negative consequences of too much added sugar. So something to watch out for sure. The calories, too, when you have the extra sugar and the extra cream and the whipped cream and all of those added goodies, you're going to have lots more calories, and then that can become a weight control issue, too.
Does all of that added sugar and fat from the cream and whipped cream, do you get a sugar high instead of a caffeine high at that point? I mean, depending on the size of the drink, I suppose, but if people are walking out of Starbucks with these massive cups topped off with whipped cream, I mean, are you really just not getting coffee at that point?
Well, you're not getting actually a lot of coffee probably, because it's so diluted with all of those other ingredients. And then we get into another question about, do you get a sugar high? You know, there's probably different research on that too. I know research says, you know, it contradicts the whole idea that sugar causes hyperactivity in children, but ask a mother, you know, about that, and she may tell you differently. But again, I'm not sure if that would cause you to have, you know, a quote-unquote sugar high. But the caffeine high would definitely, I think, be diluted by all the other things in there.
Right. And caffeine and coffee and dehydration, we're in our minds drinking a liquid. Mm-hmm. So we're thinking this is keeping us hydrated. But does it dehydrate us, or does it keep your body at the same level as if you were drinking water? Because it is water filtered through beans. So what does it come down to?
Well, we used to think that it was dehydrating, just as alcohol is. Alcohol is dehydrating. Coffee, not so much. The recent information that's come out on that is that possibly it's a little bit dehydrating, but not like we used to think. And so coffee and tea, those caffeinated drinks, we can still count that as part of our fluid intake for the day, maybe count it as 3/4 of a cup for every cup you drink. But it's still a pretty good fluid source. What they found was that it isn't as much of a diuretic as they had originally thought. So when you drink coffee, you're probably not losing as much fluid as we used to think. So drink water, you're going to have to go to the bathroom. If you drink a lot of coffee, you're also going to have to go to the bathroom. But it doesn't seem to be a hugely different effect. One other thing I was thinking about with the coffee is that it is a source of antioxidants, which is a benefit to it. And I was shocked when I was looking into it to find that it's actually the biggest source of antioxidants in the American diet.
Really?
And that is because of the sheer quantity of coffee that Americans drink. But isn't that fascinating?
It is. Yeah. I would be fair to guesstimate that probably at least 90% of adults have coffee at some point
sure.
in the day.
Sure.
So does that decrease the amount of vegetables we're getting? If someone hears what we're talking about right now, they're not going to be inclined.
Yeah, I don't say that so people stop eating their vegetables. That's not the message here.
Yeah.
Vegetables have all kinds of other things in them mm-hmm. that we still want to get fruit too. So coffee, I think the main message from all of this is, if you're like me and you really enjoy that ritual of having your morning coffee and you like the taste, you like the way it makes you feel, and you don't go overboard with it, you're probably going to be getting some nice health benefits from that too. But beyond that, it's still important to look at all the other things and what you're putting into your coffee, as we talked about.
So try and keep it as black as possible.
I would say,
or
have a little milk in it.
Okay.
And get that calcium, because for a lot of people, that could be your source of calcium for the day.
Well, Kim, it's all fascinating stuff, and I guess we'll both continue to drink our coffee. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Kim Flannery is a local registered dietitian and certified dietitian. She currently works as the nutrition director for the Wisconsin Athletic Club. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find all the parts of our ongoing coffee series at WUWM.com.
Milwaukee novelist Paul Salcini drops the final curtain on his series of historical fiction set in Tuscany. That story comes your way next when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It's been 12 years since a visit to Tuscany inspired Milwaukee writer Paul Salcini to start writing fiction.
The visit was to a restored farmhouse that had been where his grandfather lived a century before. During that trip, Salcini heard stories of relatives who had fought in the Italian resistance during the Second World War. The stories became the basis for, first, a novel called The Cielo, then a trilogy.
But the characters he created maintained their hold on Salcini, and now he's published the sixth book in their series, The Fearless Flag Thrower of Lucha, a collection of nine stories that takes place in the 1990s. Salcini, who also teaches in the journalism department at Marquette University, joined us earlier this summer in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, and thank you for having me again.
I want to start with what I guess is the subtitle of this book, which is the final volume of the sweeping A Tuscan series. And I feel like we've had several conversations before in which you promised that the series had ended, but there is definitely a note of finality to this one.
Yes, I say final, and that commits me that it is indeed the final. This is the last of the six volumes of the series. It started in World War II, and now we're in the 1990s. And the same characters have carried through the whole, all of these decades, and it's time for them to move on, and they're getting older, and they need to have their own life again.
They are getting older, but they're still around, and so you leave us in a place where we can imagine that their lives go on beyond the pages of this book.
Yes, they're still in good health, most of them, and they can survive longer. And there are new characters in the books as well, so that if they're, you know, if somebody else wants to continue the stories, they could concentrate on the younger people.
Well, and it also, I imagine, left you in a place where you could say goodbye to these characters, but they live on in your mind as well.
They are. They still do. I'm having a bit of separation anxiety because they've been with me for so long, and I've grown up with them, and they've grown up with me, and I will miss them, but they'll be fine.
Do you feel like you know them in a different way than when they first popped into your head?
I think so. When Dino was just born in the first book, and now he's in his late 40s, and Ezio was in his 20s and is in the first book, and now he's in his 70s. And so there is a progression there, and they've grown, they've changed a little bit, and they've had their problems, and Ezio had his marital problems, and they've grown, but they're doing well.
Italy has changed a great deal from
Italy
the 40s to the 2000s.
In the whole period from World War II to 2000, it has changed governments, it has changed politics, it has changed cultures. It's in a transition.
We talked in the past, in some of our past interviews, about the research you undertook to sort of credibly recreate Italy of the past. Do you feel like you were any more in touch with Italy of the recent past, or did it take quite a bit of work to credibly portray 1990s Tuscany?
I think one of the things that I portray in one of the stories in this book is the influence of migrants. And in this story, it happened in 1991, where a shipload of 17,000 Albanians crossed the Adriatic and landed in Italy. They forced the ship to go to Italy. Italy left them there for a couple of days and then sent them back home. But the fact that migrants are still going to Italy, I mean, last week, more than 1,000 migrants died on their way to Italy from North Africa. And so Italy has always been, because of its strategic location in the Mediterranean, a place where migrants can go and then perhaps go farther north into Europe. but it's their first resting stop. And it used to be Greece, but now Greece has refused them. So Italy has just become, again, a place for migrants to come, and I hope to be welcomed.
Well, and you write about this in that particular story. There are times when the migrants are welcomed, and then there are times when the pendulum swings the other way.
That's right. And Albanians come in great numbers to Italy, just because it's just across the Adriatic, a couple of hundred miles. So it's a place where and Albania is so poor that Italy is an obvious choice for them to go. And so that sometimes they're welcomed and sometimes they're not.
And that was one of the things that struck me about the story is it plays out in 1991, but it could just as easily be playing out in 2016.
It's out of today's headlines as well, yes.
There is another story. You know, one of the things that struck me as a theme throughout this book is sort of the breaking of boundaries. And the 1990s seemed like a time when things were changing in a lot of places, but perhaps no more so than in Italy. And the title story of this collection is maybe the best example.
Yeah, I've always wanted to write a story about flag throwers because I've always loved flag throwers. If people don't know what they are, they're groups of men who dress in medieval costumes, and they have these huge, huge flags. And they perform in public formation and in drills and a lot of times with drums going on in the background. And they throw these flags high in the air, like 40, 50, 60 feet high. They catch them and they throw them to each other and they do all these kind of formations. And it's very, very thrilling. So there is actually a group that comes to Festa Italiana. It came last year and it's coming again this year. And I just love to watch them because they're so agile and their precision is so great. So I've always wanted to write a story about them. So I had a story in mind about how a tradition that has long been established in flag throwing could suddenly be broken. And I don't want to tell you how that is yet.
But it's something that I think it's sort of... it's a universal here, and if not flag throwing, it could easily have been another discipline.
Sure, sure. That was a time when in Italy and elsewhere where boundaries were being broken and things were changing fast.
You also connect a couple of characters. There's Anna, and there is, will you refer to him as a televised priest?
Right, right. There's a priest, a new character in the book. Is Father Giancarlo, who is clearly modeled after Bishop Sheen, who was a great television priest in the 1960s and 70s, I think, in the United States. And everybody watched Bishop Sheen. And so Italy wanted to recreate somebody like him. And they've created Father Giancarlo. And so Father Giancarlo is a new character, and he has this television program, and he is very lonely, and he meets Anna, who is Dina's aunt, and she's very lonely, and, well, we let it go with that.
But it is a very sweet story, I thought.
Yeah, and we don't quite know, even at the end, what their relationship actually is, and we can only imagine, and that's up to the reader to decide.
Do you find yourself, as you wrote this series of six books, and you write about this in the introduction, that only a very small fraction of the characters you created were modeled on specific people.
Right.
But as you got into these characters, did you find yourself identifying with characters that maybe even surprised you as the writer?
I think I did with Ezio more than anyone else because he's been in all of the books. And he has grown and has had his troubles. And he now is a writer. He was a teacher. And so I identified with that. And he is writing a novel. And so he identified with that. And, I sort of identified more with Ezio than anybody else.
The first book was The Cello.
Right.
Did you envision it as you started that as a one-off project?
Oh, yes. I had no idea that this was going to continue. This was, I'd never written a novel before, and I wrote this novel, and it stayed in my head, and it won a couple of nice prizes. And so I felt that I needed to continue the stories of these people that I had created. And so I wrote the sequel, and then I wrote another, and then I wrote another, and it went on and on and on.
I don't know whether you work on a computer or work on longhand, but I'm curious, knowing that this was the final volume, when you got to the end, at least of the first draft of this last book in the series, it must have been an emotional time.
It was. I write on a computer, and I knew when I first started that this was going to be the end, that the 1990s, taking these people to 2000 would be the way to end it. And so it was, I knew that I had to relate these characters from one story to another, and that they all had to make sense, and they all had to sort of have a defining moment and have a definite moment in which they would end.
Do you feel joy when you are creating these characters?
Oh, yeah. I love it. I really do. I sometimes sit and I read something over and I laugh, and sometimes I read something over and I cry. I actually do, because some of these things become emotional, and when something sad happens, I feel very bad for these people. I know they're fictional, but I still feel bad for them.
Well, I think we, without giving too much away, can feel happy for most of them. We're certainly happy for you on the conclusion of this series.
Well, thank you. And thank you again for having me on this program.
Paul Salcini's latest book is called The Fearless Flag Thrower of Lucha. It's the sixth and final installment in the A Tuscan series, and it came out earlier this summer. Salcini is a longtime Milwaukee journalist, and he now teaches at Marquette University.
One last break, and then our Fit for You segment examines the weight room and how women can best take advantage of its equipment. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The weight room is often a place of intimidation for men and women alike. However, too often weight rooms and floors are dominated by men, while women stick with their cardio equipment.
However, the tide is turning, and women are being encouraged to start integrating weightlifting into their routines. But for many women, the fear of bulking up can make weightlifting seem less appealing.
Sonia Wren is a local certified personal and group trainer, and her mission is to get more women on the weight floor. For this month's Fit for You, she joined Audrey Nowakowski to talk about women and weights, and started by discussing the most common myths surrounding the practice.
Well, the first one that comes to mind is that, for the most part, women feel as though they are going to get bulky, look masculine, you know, not have that feminine physique. And that is probably one of the most, I would say, common myths out there. And I always tell people that that's virtually impossible, because we don't have enough testosterone, of course, in our bodies to have that masculine look. Secondly, I like to really focus in on all the benefits of working out as far as lifting weights. You know, you're going to, of course, develop that mental toughness. It's really good for your posture, alleviating lower back pain and increasing that muscle mass that we all want. A lot of times women, they see someone who looks incredibly fit and they think that they need to do a whole lot of cardio. And I tell them that it's really about the weightlifting. That's what's really going to change, lift, sculpt your body, give you that muscle mass that you want, but not too much.
Say we step into a gym, and often the cardio equipment is kind of in the first section of the gym and the weight room is separate. And as you mentioned, we see women mostly on treadmills, ellipticals, cardio machines, but all the men tend to dominate the weight area. So do you think it is the gym atmosphere that women come across that might stray them away from stepping out of their comfort zone to go into the weightlifting area that's dominated by men and other types of people, and the social attitudes about how women should look, what is a fit look, what is a strong look, what is a feminine look?
Yeah, I definitely think that most gyms are exactly what you said. You walk into the gym and you see women as busy as beavers, you know, over the cardio equipment. Then you see the men throwing weights and things of that nature. I really think that society has created a lot of this misconception. I feel that a lot of women feel as though it's like the danger zone. They don't want to go in that area. They look at it like it's extremely intimidating. I don't know how to get involved. I don't know how to start to get involved. And I think a lot of men are creating some of this intimidation unknowingly. Even though I am a fitness professional, I'm having a difficult time with bridging that gap in that particular environment. Although I do find myself watching and studying a lot of people in the gyms, and what I try to do to bridge that gap is just kind of walk up to them and ask them what their goals are, ask them what they're currently doing, and that usually opens Pandora's box because they usually like that. And most of them will say, you know, I do my own cardio. They're very, very motivated with their cardio, but I think it's a lack of information on women's end. They don't know where to start as far as lifting weights. They don't know what's the best way to do it. I have a class that I absolutely love, and I find that it creates that cosmopolitan melting pot for women to come and learn how to lift weights in and outside of the gym. I'm really not sure. I think that's probably one of the most difficult and thought-provoking concepts of a gym that you just said with regard to, you know, men being in a certain area, women being in a certain area. How do we bring these two populations together and get them to work harmoniously together? Because I sometimes feel on the flip side, men don't do enough cardio. They lift so many weights and they just don't do enough cardio. And then, as you already said before, women don't do the strength training that they so desperately need. So I feel like that's something that I'm working to change and correct. And it's something that I don't think we'll ever be able to fix it all the way, you know, but that's definitely something that I'm trying to work on and change.
I'm trying to bridge the gap with that. Let's start with just the basic benefits. So if a woman is on the fence about, well, I don't know if I really want to start adding strength to my workout routine, why is it important to be physically strong through lifting?
Oh my gosh, there's so many benefits to lifting weights. The first one I'm going to say is mental toughness. People don't realize the amount of confidence that you obtain when you start lifting weights. You start to feel physically and emotionally stronger. It's great for bone density. It increases muscle mass, which we all know is going to help you with reducing your body fat. Really good for posture. I'm always asked, you know, how do you keep your shoulders over your hips? You know, I think it's because of my background in weightlifting. I've been doing it for so long. And bone density, of course. So there's a ton of benefits to lifting weights. And I think that if there's anything I can do today to help a woman reach out and ask, you know, how do I start lifting weights? I feel like my journey has just begun. Yeah.
What other benefits does weightlifting give you outside of the gym as you're working throughout the day, as you're sitting? What does it do for your body to make those workouts effective after you're done?
It'll increase your body's metabolism. So if you're somebody who is actively lifting weights, I would say at least twice a week, your metabolism is going to be burning fat versus somebody who has a sedentary lifestyle. So to break that down to you, let's just say you're sleeping. You know, and then you take the sedentary person who's sleeping, then you take the person who's physically active by lifting weights. You're going to be burning more calories at rest than the person that's sedentary.
And perhaps that's something that people don't often realize because we're so focused on that calorie number that shows up on the treadmill.
Uh-huh.
I've done this much work, this many calories, and then you think it's done once you stop.
Oh, yeah. No, it's absolutely not done. Actually, it just begins. You know, so I think that that's one of the biggest benefits because women are always into counting calories. How can I burn more calories? What do I need to do? This is the perfect resolution to that.
And to help get women past the fear of getting, quote, bulky, let's break it down. Let's tackle this in a way. What actually happens to women's muscles when developed in a lifting routine?
Well, just from like a layman's terms, you are going to get sculpted. Your body's going to feel tighter. You're going to feel yourself feeling stronger. I like to say more erect. You know, your shoulders are going to be aligned over your hips. Bone density, all those wonderful things are going to happen to you when you start lifting. And don't get me wrong, cardiovascular endurance is incredibly important. I think that that is, from a mental perspective, ladies, let me break it down to you. If you're having a bad day at work, your boyfriend just broke up with you, you want to kick your boss, and you only have time to do cardio, or lift weights, I'm going to tell you, get the cardio. The cardio is a great boost for your mind, your mental stability, and you're going to leave feeling refreshed, rejuvenated. Okay, so cardio is really, really important. It really, really is important with weight loss, control, you know, that type of thing. But if you're somebody who's looking to really resculpt and change your body, and that is the numero uno question that I get as a trainer, how can I really change the shape of my body? How can I get the beautiful, you know, muscle mass in my arms, a sculpted bicep, you know, a tricep that's not like dangling? How can I get my stomach more tight? You know, how can I get more of the curvature in my legs? That is what strength training is going to do. It is going to reshape your body. Lunges, squats, bicep curls, and just food for thought. If you can do those things simultaneously, with respect to lifting weights, that's really what's going to change your body. So, for example, not to get too technical, everybody here, I'm sure, knows what a bicep curl is. I mean, you can picture it in your mind, you know, just really bending at the elbows, you know, exhaling as you come, as you bring your hand up to your upper body, and then inhaling as you come down, right? That's the traditional bicep curl, if you would put that in your mind. Everybody knows a squat, you know. If you don't know what a squat is, well, if you're sitting in a chair, stand up. You know, sit down. That'll give you a good idea. So if you can put those two elements together simultaneously, that simple bicep curl that I just described, as well as the squat, you are going to incinerate and burn tons of fat. Because what are we doing here? We're moving the hands, we're moving the arms, we're moving the upper body, we're moving the legs in conjunction with that lower body. You are working your core muscles, which is a whole nother topic that we should talk about, you know, the importance of core. But you are working your core muscles because you have the legs and the arms working together simultaneously. So, strength training has been a huge portion of my life. I've been exercising since the age of 9. I've been an athlete all my life. I was also a fitness model, and now I'm a fitness professional. And I know the power of what strength can do. So I feel like it's my job to really enlighten everybody about this journey and how it can really change your perspective on life.
Well, and it seems like changing the shape and changing one's outlook in lifting weights really overcomes that hurdle of what a feminine body is supposed to look like.
Yes.
Because your body will change into what your body's meant to look like.
Yes.
With these weights, it seems.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And when you make comments like that, I can't help but to say Serena Williams. She has absolutely the most phenomenal body. It's just so incredibly strong. And you might look at it from a woman's perspective and say, that's not how a woman's supposed to look. Well, it's strength. It is pure, you know, 100% strength. And even if you don't like it, you have to respect it, because you know that she is, on top of being genetically gifted, which is a whole nother topic, you can also tell that she has completely put in the work.
And with work extending not only in weightlifting, mm-hmm. but other classes people might do or other exercises, running, spinning, group fitness, anything like that. Mm-hmm. Does weightlifting help to supplement and benefit all these other kinds of exercise classes or practices that people are participating in?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the first thing that comes to mind is injury prevention. For me, I'm a big proponent of that. So everything that I do as far as strength training, there's always an injury component in it with respect to like physical therapy. I deal with lots of runners, so they're more prone to have lots of injuries associated with running. So we really work on lots of strength training exercises, like simple single leg deadlift is great. People might say, well, why? What about that exercise? Well, as you already know, it's a single leg deadlift. So what you're doing is you're strengthening the foot, the knee, and the hip of that side. Okay. And that is extremely important, especially if you're somebody who's running. So I would say that injury prevention is probably one of the most beneficial aspects of strength training. I am a former college basketball player, and I can honestly say that I've only battled through one injury, and it was pretty small. So, and I think that a lot of why I'm here today at my age and still being able to exercise like this is because of the injury prevention component in strength training.
And for women or men, just people in general, mm-hmm. you see different kinds of weight equipment in the gym floor. You have free weights. You have machines based with pulley systems.
Right.
Many different ways to tackle lifting. And for someone who is new at it, may look at it and say, I have no clue.
Yeah.
Where do I start? So is there a more effective way to approach these?
That's a great question because you can get so overwhelmed because there's so many ways to do this. I like to start people off on the Nautilus equipment. I think that's the best option because people don't realize that the Nautilus equipment provides the balance, the stability, and the range of motion for you. It stabilizes the body in a very safe manner. You don't have to worry about hyperextending, overextending, having improper form. It kind of places the body exactly where it should be and then isolates the muscles that it's targeting. And then once you start them off there and see how they fare in a progressive fashion, then I like to use the gym toys. To me, the gym toys are the best way to get an absolutely amazing workout because the sky's the limit. I feel like the Nautilus equipment, there's so many different limitations. You can only contort or move the body in a certain way when you're in a certain piece of machine. So I am a big fan of the Bosu balls, the dumbbells. I love the med balls. Med balls are great from the perspective of it really sharpens hand-eye ball coordination, which is so central.
And to conclude it and bringing it back to women in weights, what would you say? Here's a shout out to all women out there who are still unsure, ready to cross that barrier to go into the weight room. What's the one statement of encouragement you would say to them?
I would say that no matter how difficult this seems or no matter how uncomfortable you feel, stick with it. There is going to be something that is going to be incredibly positive for you out of this situation. The first thing I would do is if I was at a gym, I would go to the front desk and just ask if there's somebody that's available to walk me through the weights, the weight machines. I think that's a great way to start because that person will familiarize you with all of the machines, show you how to use them, and then in turn, they'll probably say, you know, would you like for me to show you how to maybe use the dumbbells? And that's how it all starts. And you're going to be hooked because you're going to love the confidence. You're going to love how you feel. You're going to love how you look. You're going to love how you walk. You know, you're going to walk with more confidence. And all those things will trickle into your personal life. So that's what I would say. Yeah.
Well, Sonia, thanks so much for coming in and helping give women a lift up, so to speak.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Sonia Wren is a local AFAA certified group and personal fitness trainer. She spoke with Audrey Nowakowski. For more information on women and weights or to listen to all of our previous Fit for You segments, visit WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for yet another edition of Lake Effect right here on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.